Alex was an African gray parrot who demonstrated the capacity of animals to learn language. When he died unexpectedly in August of 2007, there was an outpouring of grief for an animal who had literally spoken to us. Irene M. Pepperberg was Alex's trainer and companion of 30 years, and her new book, Alex and Me, is the story of this unique and wonderful relationship. It's published by HarperCollins. I'm very pleased it has brought her to our show today. Hi.
Hello. Thank you for having me here.
How old was Alex when he died?
31, which is actually a bit young for a parrot.
What's their average lifespan?
Oh, more like 40, maybe 50.
Oh, so it wasn't incredibly young.
No, but just I thought I had 10 more years with him at least.
So this came as a shock?
Very much so.
Do we know why he died?
Heart arrhythmia. Something that you can't plan for, you can't figure out it's going to happen, you have no expectations.
Jay Leno imagined that his last words were, "Yes, I do want a cracker." But what were his last words to you?
It was a standard goodbye routine. It's been written up as something very special, but it was our standard goodnight routine, and it was something that we would exchange. Sometimes he'd say one part of it, sometimes I'd say the other, but, I'm going to go eat dinner. You be good. I love you. I love you, too. I'll see you tomorrow. Yes, I'll be in tomorrow. And the tomorrow was actually important because if I was going away on a trip, I'd say, no, I won't be in tomorrow. I'll be gone for 5 days. So he would know that I wouldn't be in the next day. Not that he could actually figure out sense of time in 5 days, but that he knew that there would be a break.
Were you surprised by the reaction to his death?
It was overwhelming.
Because the Times wrote it up? The Economist gave him a full-scale obituary?
Yes. I mean, it was just overwhelming.
And you'd been with him for 30 years?
30 years, that's correct, yeah.
So he was much more than a subject to you. He was really a companion. How different is the bonding of the sort that you did with him from what happens when people have much-loved dogs and cats?
Well, for the 30 years that we worked together in the laboratory, I really had a barrier between us. I cared for him a lot. I cared for him the way you would care for a colleague with whom you worked for 30 years. I mean, you do. You care. You care what happens to them. They're part of your life. But to maintain my scientific objectivity, I had to keep an emotional block. And then after he died, well, there wasn't going to be any more science. And that emotional barrier just completely crumbled.
No more science because he was the only parrot you could do this work with?
No, no more science with him. Mm-hmm. No more science with him.
But was that a problem, that you might not find a parrot as smart as Alex?
Well, we have two other birds in the lab. One of them, Griffin, is really quite smart. The issue with Griffin is that we spent a lot of his 13 years testing out the training technique that we used with Alex. So he had a barrage of different types of training techniques and basically only had a quarter of the training of the modeling technique that really worked. So at 13, he's really about the stage Alex was at 3.5, which is perfectly fine. And, he's doing very well. But again, it's not, where Alex was for a lot of reasons.
What came first, the scientific interest or a love of birds?
Well, there was a basic love of birds. As a child, I grew up above a store. There were no other children around. My mother was not a very warm, wonderful, cuddly type person. My father worked full time, went to school, and was taking care of his sick mother, so he'd kiss me good morning, and I wouldn't see him till the next day. And he bought me a budgie to keep me company. Again, an apartment, it wasn't a good thing for a dog or a cat, so he bought this little budgie. So I joked that was the only thing that talked to me all day, but I did bond to it, and I had always had this love of birds. And then you fast forward to graduate school. I was getting a degree in theoretical chemistry at Harvard. And, I kind of joke again about it that, what took me 7 years, at the time I thought, computers are going to get better. It'll be 7 hours. Now it's probably 7 nanoseconds to do those experiments. But, I was not terribly enamored of staying in the field and saw the NOVA programs on the signing chimps, the dolphin work. And
so a PBS show really got you started on all this work?
Three of them, the dolphins ones, the ape ones, and the why do birds sing, where they were discussing how birds learn their vocalizations. And I'm going, but I had a budgie. It learned to talk. Why isn't anybody doing this animal-human communication stuff with a bird?
Well, birds have often been, if you want to insult somebody, you say that he's a bird brain. So, and birds do have very small brains, don't they? Isn't that a reason that people don't take them all that seriously as intelligent animals?
Well, it was. Nowadays, we know that it's not the size of the brain, but the size of the brain relative to the body weight. And more importantly, the size of a cortical-like area. That's the part of the mammalian brain that's responsible for intelligence, and it's the relative size of this cortical area to the whole brain and to the size of the animal. And if you look at that, people are doing these types of studies now, you find that this parrot has a relatively humongous area devoted to intelligence and to communication.
Others had tried experiments with parrots, hadn't they, and not had much success?
They had, and they used the standard so-called operant conditioning techniques of the day, where you basically lock an animal in a sound isolation box, starve it down to 80% of its normal body weight, and give it, you know, like a red light, and then you turn off the red light, and then you give it a red and a green light, and you see how long it takes to learn to hit the red light.
To get some food.
And again, it's we call it a non-referential reward. You just get a piece of food for doing it. And, you know, I tell my students, okay, think about how you feel when you've missed lunch. You know, how would you feel 80% of your body weight stuck in front of a computer, and you have no idea what you're really supposed to do in front of that computer, and you bang the keys, and every once in a while a piece of food pops up. And so,
but this is a very limited example of intelligence.
Right, right.
And you're not really proving very much.
Well, the thing is that in the interim 30 years, people have indeed used this technique to show that pigeons can do some really, really exciting stuff. But that wasn't happening that much in the 70s.
Well, why did you choose an African gray to work with?
Well, I chose a gray for several reasons. First, they have really, really clear speakers. They're known for the clarity of their speech. Second, there were several projects in Germany by Otto Kuhler, who had worked with gray parrots and showed they had really good number concepts, that they were actually able to communicate with humans, being trained by a modeling technique that one of Kuhler's assistants, Dietmar Tode, had demonstrated. So I had this background that I didn't have to replicate.
But you were going to put them into an unnatural situation. These are very sociable birds. They live in flocks, and you're going to take him and isolate him.
No, I was going to give him a flock of humans.
And is that the way you think Alex saw it?
I think so. Because he was with humans 8 to 10 hours a day. He wasn't left alone in the cage ever, except at nighttime when the lights were off. So there were always people talking to him, treating him like a toddler, essentially.
Well, he had an advantage, oddly, over the chimps who learn language, in that he could actually speak.
Right, right. And again, I don't call this language. I'm really careful not to call it language, because language would mean that you could have put him in front of this microphone and interviewed him instead of me. So I call it a two-way communication system. And I'm really careful about that, because it was not nearly as complicated as what you and I are engaging in.
But he was picking up on cues and responding, which is different. That's closer to communication than just simply Polly want a cracker.
Oh, yeah. He was interacting with us, and that's why I call it animal-human communication. Yeah.
And you started off teaching him the word paper as his first word. Is that because the P sound is really difficult to make if you don't have lips?
Well, that was the downside of it. What we did was we gave him a bunch of different objects to determine which of these objects he liked the best, and we thought, well, we would teach him the label for that object. And then there would be this one-to-one correspondence of the label and the object, and he would use the label to request the object. Unfortunately for us, paper was his favorite thing, and those P sounds are really hard.
Did he ever get it down?
Oh, yes, but initially it was A-er.
And in your case, I mean, he couldn't say your last name very well. Pepperberg.
Probably not.
The P and the B probably would have been difficult. Irene M. Pepperberg is my guest. She's written Alex and Me, How a Scientist and a Parrot Uncovered a Hidden World of Animal Intelligence and Formed a Deep Bond in the Process. It's published by HarperCollins. So you wound up doing this in a goal, you say, to prove that parrots had cognitive processes that previously only humans and primates were thought to have.
That is correct.
Are there other animals that might have them as well?
Oh, dolphins for sure, sea lions. Basically, the issue is that until we do the appropriate experiments with a whole range of animals, we'll never know what they can show us.
So anyway, so he likes paper, and you get him to say paper. But haven't we known this about parrots all along? After all, they do ask for those crackers.
Well, the point in my study was not to just teach him to label things like paper, but to go on and teach him adjectives, colors and shapes, numbers, to see if he could understand that there was the label color, and that under that label color went green, blue, orange, and, you know, purple, and under shape was 2, 3, 4, 5, 6 corner, and under matter was, you know, metal and paper and wood and rawhide and things like that. Concepts of bigger and smaller, concepts of same and different. actual concepts of number.
And he got all of that?
And he got all of that.
Were you associated with the university when you were doing this?
Various universities.
And were they all happy to give you funding? Because this sort of thing usually faces a certain amount of resistance, doesn't it?
Well, universities never give professors, almost never give professors any kind of funding. Universities give you a space, and then you write to government grant agencies or private foundations to get the funding, and then the universities take a certain amount of overhead to keep running the place.
But so, you also run into all sorts of philosophical arguments here. There are a lot of people who believe that language is what separates humans from animals, and they resist any kind of mitigation of the difference.
Right, and again, that's why I'm very careful not to say that what we did was language. Again, people argue that even the communication that we developed wasn't enough to show that Alex had these abilities. But that's where I differ. I mean, I agree with them when they say language, you know, we have language. They don't have our type of language. But they did learn a communication system that we could look at and use, exploit even, to examine their intelligence.
And how different was it from the kind of communication or whatever word we want to use with primates?
Because it was vocal. And the nice thing about that was that it was something that was completely spontaneous. So most of the studies with primates, not most, but about half of them, used language boards or used plastic chips that the animals had to manipulate. The signing animals were the closest to what Alex did because, again, everything in their repertoire was available all the time.
It's my sense that you were entering into an area of science that others were abandoning.
Interestingly, that really was exactly the timing. The papers had been coming out in 79 was Herb Terrace's paper on Can an Ape Create a Sentence, and in 1980 there was the Clever Hans conference in New York. And so my first paper came out in 81, which was not great timing.
But then Alex learned the concept of no.
Well, of none, I guess that's the one you really want to talk to, right?
Mm-hmm.
That was interesting because we wanted to look at absence because absence is a really tricky issue. Absence means a presumption of presence. It's like when, you know, it's in the evening, it's 9 o'clock, you're kind of hungry, you go to the fridge, you open it up, you respond one way if you're just sort of looking for something, and you respond another way if you had an expectation of the presence of some chocolate cake that's now missing. So how do you get that in an animal? And we did an end run. We had already taught him concepts of same and different. So we could show him two things and say, what's same and what's different? And he could say color, shape, or matter. And now we trained him to teach to say none if nothing were same or different.
But then he even learned the names of colors, didn't he?
Oh, yes. Yeah, yeah.
So parrots are not colorblind?
No. In fact, they actually have better color vision than we do. They see four different chromatic systems. So he would see in the ultraviolet. And for that reason, a lot of the toys, we had to, you know, choose a bottle of non-toxic paint and paint everything that shade of purple in order to get him to tell us it was purple. We agreed on this is purple. I don't care what you really see, but we're going to call this shade purple.
Then he learned how to say, I'm sorry. Now, that is a really complex thought.
Well, it is if you think there's contrition. And there wasn't necessarily contrition. He had learned it in an interesting little incident. He was on a perch, and I had left a coffee cup in a place I didn't think he could get to. And I walked out the door to go to the washroom, and I come back, and there he is on the floor, walking amidst shards of coffee cup and coffee. And, of course, as any parent might, you know, what happened? How did you do that? You know, you start emoting about that, and he's looking at me. And then I realize, wait, you know, this is crazy. This is a bird. So I pick him up, and I say, I'm sorry. I'm sorry. And he learned that that was something you say to diffuse a situation, but no contrition.
Just one more thing before you go. How did others explain some of these things? Because there are always doubters. For example, Alex using the word apple. You had a friend who was a linguist who interpreted what happened there.
Well, he made up the label binary. And the idea was, you know, where did this come from? And I had no idea, and I called my linguist colleague, and he said, oh, you know, it probably tastes like a banana and looks like a large cherry.
Hmm.
You know, we didn't know where that came from, but Alex obviously had his own label for it.
So he was making up words as well. That's pretty good.
A few.
And then he died, and you had to find other parrots. One you dismissed because he was kind of ADHD.
Well, that was I dismissed that bird a long time before, and because of that. When Alex died, we had two other birds in the lab, Griffin and Arthur, and I've talked a little bit about Griffin. Arthur we actually got when I was at the media lab to do computer work, and he's not very interested in talking, but he does physical problems.
Well, that's why we didn't invite him here as a guest, but we did have Irene M. Pepperberg, whose book, Alex and Me, How a Scientist and a Parrot Uncovered a Hidden World of Animal Intelligence and Formed a Deep Bond in the Process, published by Collins. Thank you so much for being with us.
Oh, thank you for having me.